Hi, this is Richard Parker with Diomo, and today we're going to discuss, are you paying too much for a business and how to accurately value any company? Buying a business involves both clear-cut, black-and-white issues and many gray areas as well. To me, valuing a business comprises a bit of both. It's straightforward because we're dealing with numbers and numbers don't lie. But we're also dealing with people, and unfortunately, people do lie. You also have to realize that business owners have enormous emotional attachments to their businesses, and this comes shining through when it's time for them to sell. I've always said that what a seller thinks their business is worth has absolutely nothing to do with its real value. The good news is that valuations are nowhere near as complicated as you might believe. One of the most frequent comments we get from clients is they love our materials because they're no-nonsense, no BS, down-to-earth, real-life strategies that work. We don't teach classroom theory. In this session, we're going to take a complicated piece of the business buying process and simplify it for everyone, regardless of your level of experience with business valuations. Whether you're a beginner or expert, you're going to gain a wealth of great advice today. My expert this month is Andy Cagnetta, and he's here to share his vast knowledge with us. Andy is a certified business appraiser, a certified business intermediary, and also owner of one of the country's largest and most successful independent business brokerage firms, Transworld Business Brokers of Florida. He and I have known each other for about 10 years. Despite his impressive credentials, Andy fully understands and preaches business valuations from a real-world point of view. He's also super smart, honest, and one of the most charitable people I've ever met. Andy understands the business buying process from all sides since he's bought several companies himself. Today we're going to talk about a number of different aspects of business valuations, including why would anyone with a sane mind ever sell an undervalued business? You'll learn how you can easily identify undervalued businesses. We'll discuss what's the best method to use to establish the correct valuation for a business. You'll know how to negotiate the right price and terms when a seller has priced his business too high. You'll be very clear about what you can do to completely avoid being ripped off and overpaying for a business. You'll understand how factors like location, geography, the economy, and competition affect the value of a business. And our expert hot seat session will give you some incredible additional insight into business valuations. And of course, there'll be a whole lot more on this critical subject matter. Andy, I've really been looking forward to this interview for a long time. So without waiting any longer, let's just get started. On behalf of myself and everyone listening, welcome today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You know, your career is truly inspiring. Can you briefly tell everyone your story and touch on where you started out and how you became one of the top experts in business valuations, in addition to one of the most successful business brokerage owners in the country?
Well, I came to business brokerage as a buyer, and I came to Transworld looking to buy a business. In 1994, I had owned a few different businesses at that time, and my father-in-law wanted to drag me and my wife, who was expecting his first grandchild to South Florida, and we didn't go too unwillingly. So we wound up in South Florida, and I started looking at different business brokerages and different businesses to buy, and I went around, and I was really kind of unhappy with my search process. And then I met Transworld, and I really liked the owners of Transworld. Don and Bonnie Parrish treated me very professionally. Don's a 30-year IBM executive, and he ran his office that way, and they eventually through meeting some of the agents, they invited me to join, and I thought that would be a good idea of understand because I was so afraid of business valuation. That was one of my biggest fears. Here I was borrowing money from my father-in-law, and I figured if I lost his money, I would lose my wife at the same time. So I thought it was so important not to buy something that, A, the economy or the South Florida economy didn't need, and I didn't know that because I wasn't from South Florida. And the second thing was to overpay. And that's, I think, a lot of buyers' fears. So that kind of goes right into what we're talking about today. And when I got into business brokerage, I always thirst for knowledge. So I went out immediately and got my CBI, which is my Certified Business Intermediary. Went right from there and went to the IBA, which is the Institute of Business Appraisers, and got my CBA, which is Certified Business Appraiser. And because I wanted to learn how to value businesses. We've seen literally thousands of businesses sell here at Transworld. I've been very fortunate to work with great people and help build my business brokerage. And that's where we are today.
It's pretty interesting because you've gone from, I remember seeing you at one or two office place above a restaurant east of here to five or six offices with 85 agents. And
yeah, we have 10 offices now, but you know, including the satellite offices. But yeah, we have 85 agents now, and We got some good growth capital along the way. We'll talk about that some other day. But and just hard work and doing the right thing for people and getting involved in the community, and it's been a great ride.
Well, it's a fantastic story, and I know you're a wealth of information, so we're going to jump right into the valuations, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening are hoping to be able to duplicate your success. Again, it's a great, great story that couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. You know, one thing I want every listener to know clearly is that the asking price of a business is not the selling price, and they shouldn't be, you know, confusing the two. But with that in mind, let's discuss the mindset of a business owner who puts his business up for sale and how they price it. So, you know, one of the questions that I asked earlier is, you know, why would someone with a sane mind ever sell an undervalued business?
Because they don't know better or they're sick and tired of it. You know, it's funny, when people get to the end of their business career, oftentimes, and we'll understand valuation, we'll talk more about it, if it's a two-time multiple or three-time multiple, it's not a huge financial gain at the end of the road. Really, a business owner should make their money during the time. And I think people get so just sick and tired of running their businesses that they're willing really to step aside for very little money. And then people just don't understand valuation, and they might sell it for less than it may be worth.
And you also have all the issues of, you know, what I enjoy when a business for sale are all the morbid reasons of, you know, death, divorce, illness, or whatever. I mean, there's a whole host of those reasons as well why someone could potentially, you know, sell an undervalued business.
Well, fair market value, the definition of fair market value is that everybody has reasonable knowledge of the relevant facts and neither is acting under compulsion. Well, that's never true.
Right.
Somebody's under compulsion.
If not, they wouldn't buy and the other one wouldn't sell.
Right. So if the seller is under compulsion, that's when you want to buy.
Absolutely. You know, years ago, a highly respected and successful business broker we both know told me that a business is overpriced the minute it's listed for sale. What a seller thinks his business is worth is usually far greater than its real value. So here's my question. You know, why would they price it too high?
I think because people are, you know, there's everybody whispering in the seller's ear, and usually it's their accountant or their mother-in-law or their attorney telling them how businesses sell for multiple times. And you know what? People get a lot of information from the news. And when things sell in the news, like YouTube sells for ridiculous amounts of money and these guys were working out of their garage, or they look at the stock market and, you know, Microsoft trades for 40 times. People get that in their heads, and that's what they think these small businesses for sell for. So, and listen, everybody's hoping for the best. And so if you truly look at valuation, valuation is a range. Businesses are going to sell in a range for a number of reasons, and I guess everybody's hoping to sell on the high side.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice, but it somewhat defeats the purpose, I guess, if your objective is really to sell the business. Now, most people are very concerned about being able to establish a fair value for a small business, and rightfully so. I mean, your company, Transworld, has sold thousands of businesses in its 25-plus years. How often do businesses not sell simply because they're priced too high?
I think a majority of the time. You know, listen, businesses sell in a range. And I think when people sign up for the first time, they're looking for the high side of the range. And, you know, there's everybody talking to them, their attorneys, their accountants, their mother-in-laws, and they're all whispering in their ears. And a lot of people look at the news and they see YouTube selling for billions of times, or they look at the public markets and they sell Microsoft trades for 40 times. You know, and you and I have talked about this before, that it's a down payment-driven business. I mean, if somebody has good terms and a decent price and they have a good debt structure to where they can make positive amount of money, enough to make them a living while they're paying off the business and growing the business, it's a home run. And if businesses would just stop and look at that, you know, what we call the reality test, I think they would sell more often.
So it is fair to say that a good percentage of the businesses that don't sell will not sell simply because they price them too high and there's no flexibility on the part of the seller.
I think that's absolutely true.
So from your expertise, if a seller's not even in the ballpark of having a realistic value, will they come down, or, you know, should the buyer just move on because there are, you know, lots of other businesses for sale?
If I'm talking to buyers, I tell them never, ever be afraid to make an offer. Never. You just don't know where that seller is mentally that day, that week, that month. And I've seen some huge moves over a short amount of time where a seller was so determined that they were going to get, say, $1 million, And then 2 weeks later, they're taking $600,000, which is the real price.
You know, it's a very, very valid point because we talk about so often in the materials that you have to make offers. And it's not from a standpoint of throwing out 30 offers, hoping somebody will accept it. It's making offers in as much to, A, bring the seller to reality, and, B, it starts the juices flowing. I mean, it's the only thing that starts a meaningful dialogue between buyer and seller. And in addition to that, it's, as you say, you never know what someone's thinking on a particular day. From your experience, on average, how long does a business have to be on the market before the seller may reduce the price or become very flexible on their price?
If they have a good business broker and they're giving them good feedback, it should start coming down, say, after 30 to 60 days. If initially in that 30, 60 days they don't get an offer or they don't have a lot of traffic, that, you know, the business broker should be advising them to bring the business down. It really depends on their motivation. We talked about compulsion earlier. I mean, if a seller is compulsive, we sold a business one time. The guy was walking around the office, walking around this factory, and he was literally dragging his oxygen tank because they had just removed the lung. And he's, you know, he stopped halfway through the tour showing us the business because he wanted to sell. And he looked at us and he said, "You know, I don't have to sell."
And you can buy here. You have to sell it, right? You know,
and literally, we sold the business within 48 hours.
Right.
And it was a good business, and he priced it right, and he even negotiated on that price to sell the business right away. And
well, he priced it to sell.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting because one of the points you mentioned, if there's no action within 30 days, you know, I often tell people, you know, someone outside of our industry doesn't really understand. A good business is sell super fast, and a good business, regardless of the economic times, within 30 days of it being listed, if it's a good business, it will be under contract. So, you know, it's interesting that someone who maybe just be getting into this understands that an aggressive seller, a motivated seller, if they don't see in 30 days some action, and a business broker who's guiding them effectively will say, hey, if this was priced right, if it's a good business, and I believe it is, and if it's priced right, we would have seen some action already. We haven't. It's time to adjust the price. Can you give us some specific examples of what sellers typically overvalue in the business or certain aspects of a business that will cause sellers to set their asking prices too high? In other words, in what parts of a business do sellers typically overestimate the value?
Well, typically they overestimate their inventory. They always do that. I mean, and they think inventory should really drive a price, which in many ways, inventory is a detriment to a business. And a good business is turning its inventory several times. And I've seen businesses that have too much excess inventory. It's really not turning. And they think that they should get all their value for that inventory. In fact, they want retail value for that inventory. So that really holds them back. Also, their goodwill. And their personal goodwill. And, you know, they said, I've been in this business for 20 years. They think they should get paid for 20 years of goodwill. And that's just not the case.
You know, it's a case the business was good for that 20 years for them.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily translate to being immediately good for somebody else.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Business brokers who represent the seller certainly want to get the best price in terms possible. Not, you know, you know this. I get way too many complaints about brokers who simply don't possess the experience or know how to substantiate the price they've priced a business. Obviously, there are lots of good brokers, but the majority of them seem to either state, well, you know, that's what the seller wants or that's what these type of businesses sell for. So how does a buyer get past the broker gatekeeper at this point?
Well, I think that they're going to have to point to third parties, just like yourself. I mean, all the materials that you have that you can provide them will help them. Comps, third-party valuations, maybe that's a way that they can get a reasonably priced third-party valuation to determine what the real price of the business is. And I think they just have to be convincing to the seller. They have to sell themselves. And we've talked about that in other materials that you do, that, you know, a seller will sell a business at a lesser price if they think they're the right buyer. And so that's what they should focus on, having a good relationship with the seller, proving their model, their valuation through maybe third-party reference guides, and try to get past the broker just by speaking to the seller directly sometimes.
That's just great information about the seller's whole thought process and really super helpful information. So let's move on to help our listeners identify and acquire some undervalued business, or cover that topic a little bit. And I'm a huge believer in buying undervalued businesses. For me, these are businesses that can be grown quickly by the right person. They may have been priced below market or have owners that have, who've lost their passion. And, you know, typically they're good, solid companies that can become great under the right new owner. From your perspective, what determines an undervalued business?
What determines an undervalued business is the buyer's skill set. A business is worth what it's going to make in the future for a buyer. If the buyer goes in there knowing that they can grow the profits and revenues through their skill set, and you've said it before, that's the most important thing, that a buyer knows what drives that business. And if that person has the skills to drive that business much bigger than an unmotivated or uneducated or simply a bad owner. We've said it before. Are there more bad businesses or bad owners? There's more bad owners. So if a buyer could get in there and apply their skill set and grow the business and they know it, that's a win. That's a huge win.
That's really interesting. You know, now, how far does a business have to be undervalued to be a good buy?
It doesn't even have to be undervalued at all. I mean, really, it doesn't. And we've talked about this before, too. It could even be a little bit overpriced, because it doesn't matter. If they know they can grow the business with their skill set, the business is going to be worth so much more to them than buying a business that has no ability to grow or no capacity to grow, or they're going to do horribly with. I mean, you know, that'd be like putting a salesperson in a gas station. They might get a great price for it, but what are they going to do? Go out on the road and start dragging more cars in? They can't do that. So you put a salesperson into a sales business, and even if they pay over a little bit and they could grow the business by 25, 30% year after year, that's a home run.
Yeah, I mean, this is very often what we always talk about is, you know, value is perception, and it's okay to, you know, it's okay to overpay for the right business, but buying the wrong business is never a bargain at any price.
Exactly.
You know, are there any telltale signs that a business could be undervalued? I mean, certain things that perhaps an owner has looked at certain aspects of it, or they're really not in tune with what's coming in the future?
I think a lot of businesses that have been around for a very long time are usually undervalued. I love businesses that have been around 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, businesses like that just have shown in the marketplace. They're not going anywhere. And I think if a business has been flat, literally flat, year after year after year, there's something wrong. The owner's not driving it. It has a customer base that is loyal to it. And that probably shows you that the business is undervalued.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting example, because if I look at a business like that, you know, I think from a buyer's perspective, I love businesses like that, because they're very typically bland, boring. They're not going up. They're not going down. They have a loyal customer base, customers who typically buy from them year after year after year, only for the only reason that they buy from is that they buy from them year after year after year. There's not necessarily anything compelling, but the owner hasn't done anything to market that business. It's held its own, and the buyer has a huge advantage being able to really negotiate a tough deal to show a seller, say, hey, your business has shown no growth for the last decade. It is not worth X. It's actually worth X minus Y. So that's a perfect example of a business that either could be potentially undervalued or purchased at a, you know, far below market value price. So in keeping with that, how can you really tell if a business is undervalued or potentially is just priced low because of it's full of problems?
Well, you have to do your due diligence. You have to go in there and check it out and make sure that the business doesn't have any underlying problems. Once again, a business is worth what it's going to make in the future. I mean, all the valuation methods value future income, of course, based on the past, but future income is so important. So if you could go in there and make sure that nothing is detrimental has happened to this business that's going to hurt the supply chain or the customer base, or there's no one customer that has left recently, those are businesses that you could probably feel assured that they're okay. They just haven't been attended to in a long time. You know, the other business that could be undervalued is something that's just about to do the rocket ship ride. Maybe it's only been in business 1 or 2 years and they've laid all the groundwork. And we've talked about that businesses, I forget what the stat is, but 90% go out of business in 96% in the first 3 years. Well, it's lasted 3 years. And the and the entrepreneur has done all the tough slugging, right. all the walk through this, you know, the swamp, and now it's just about to emerge, and entrepreneurs get scared. They almost get scared of their own growth sometimes. Right. So maybe it's time for someone who's a business operator to come in there. You know, the typical, there's guys who love to start things up and have no clue how to run things. So maybe you just jump in there right as the business is going to take off.
It's, you know, what we're saying is the, you know, someone else has gone through the start, gone through all the pain of the startup, and it's someone else now to take it over and make that into, you know, a good existing business. Is there really a way to tell if the potential of a business is maxed out? I mean, what are a couple of signs, you know, two or three signs that you would look at in a business that would give you, you know, based on your experience, an indication, you know, that business is pretty, it's mature. I mean, there really isn't a whole lot of room for growth or, you know, it's sort of at its plateau.
Well, I would look at the economy, the general economy of that business, the industry itself. You know, if you were into the typewriter repair business, I would say that has been maxed out maybe several years ago, or the wagon wheel business. You know, that we always laugh when we point to those kind of things. But, you know, I would be careful of, you know, like if you wanted to buy a speed shop right now for business, for cars that go real fast or use a lot of horsepower. I mean, maybe that would be something that's going to be contracting because of the economy, because of rising fuel costs. So I would look for that, number one. And number two is if they're running two and three shifts inside of a manufacturing company, perhaps that means that they've grown out of capacity in that facility. So you know, you have to be careful of your price to include the fact that you're going to have to put in CapEx or, you know, capital expenditures to help grow their business. Might not be a bad thing. Just recognize that you're going to have to make investments into that business. I mean, and there's, you got to be careful of computer technology. You know, you look around and people are running Windows 95 on all their computers, or some old technology. You realize that you're going to have to put in time, money, and expense to take it to the next level.
Yeah, it's interesting because some of the example that I like to use is, you know, people are get enamored with the self-storage business or document storage business, and it's great and it's recurring revenue, and they'll show you a warehouse and it's row upon row upon row of boxes of documents or people storage and very little turnover, and if people don't pay the bills, they lock, you know, they knock off their locks and they put someone into place. But the only problem is once all those places are filled, you can't build that business unless you open up a new, you're in the real estate business at that point. I mean, the only way you're going to grow, yeah, it's a nice, solid, sustainable cash flow. But the only way to grow that business, you've got to build a new facility.
They're under capacity. I mean, they just don't have any more
They're
capacity.
Maxed out.
Right.
You know, there's no doubt that undervalued businesses are out there in great numbers. And so at these pointers, our listeners will really be able to make some tremendous strides. I mean, this is just great information. So let's get into some of the real nitty-gritty stuff. And most people are scared stiff about overpaying for business. And who can blame them, really? I mean, part of the issue is that most buyers don't have a clue how to do valuations, and it really handcuffs them. We're now going to put the whole theory of valuations into plain English for everyone, and Andy, you're the guy to do just that. So now, there are many different valuation models, and this is a big part of the confusion for most people, because we've heard so many terms like asset valuations, discounted cash flow, CapEx, and multiples, and so forth. Can you discuss each one of these methods briefly, how they're calculated, and what are the pros and cons of each?
Well, there's three basic methods to valuing a business. There's the asset method, which is literally just adding up the assets, minusing the liabilities, and that's what the business is worth. The complication in that method is that you're supposed to value the intangibles also, the goodwill and all those kind of things. And there's extremely difficult methods for doing that, the excess earnings method and all these other methods for doing that, working costs of capital methods. And usually the asset method for existing businesses that are making money, usually that method is thrown out anyway. So let's just take that and throw it out. So then you have two other methods that are used to value businesses. One of them is the income method. And the income method is estimating future cash flow and doing a present value of that. And these present value and these future cash flows and future discounted earnings, discounted earnings method can be very, very complicated. And one of the simpler ways to do it is they put a cap rate on one earnings period and factor in the growth. And that can be very difficult too, because picking out that income stream that should be capitalized can be extremely random.
It's like going hunting at night or shooting darts blindfolded. I mean, it is really trying to predict the future.
It is trying to predict the future. And then the other thing is picking a cap rate, because then you could start arguing, what cap rate should be picked and what discounts should be applied to it and what minority and all kinds of other market conditions. And really, no single person could put a no amateur and even experts argue these things in books. And so the income method is a tough method also. Not a bad method, but there are some income methods that have been simplified. Now, the last method is the market method. And basically what people have done in the past is taken either revenues or income, and we can talk about the different income names in a few minutes, EBITDA or owner's benefit or seller's discretionary earnings, whatever you want to call it, and they apply either a multiple or a gross percentage based on comparables in the marketplace that have happened before. And this method is becoming much more reliable because so many businesses have sold, and that information is now starting to get out there in the marketplace and being verified and being stored, and people are able to get those comps and be able to easily use those comps. And out of all those methods start to become rules of thumb for certain industries and generalities based that we can use, that we could teach people today.
So now, if out of these three methods, we have the first one, which is an asset method, which really isn't applicable to me. That would be someone, you know, you're going into a shopping center. There's a restaurant that was there before. They've got all kinds of equipment that someone can go in and start a new concept. But the equipment is there. They buy the assets only. They buy them at book value or whatever price they can negotiate. But that's the asset method. Typically doesn't work. The discounted cash flow seems to either predict the future or bring in way too many arbitrary numbers into play. And it's probably way beyond. And that's great to try to guess the future. But I figure if I meet someone who can guess the future, I'm either taking them to Las Vegas or I'm taking them to buy lotto tickets. So then a multiple of owner benefits sounds to me like that's clearly going to bring into play a lot of things. And clearly the method that I subscribe to, which is, you know, you're going to bring a lot of things into play, including a buyer achieving a proper return on their investment relative to other investments that they can potentially make. So, you know, provide us, if you will, with the exact formula again that you would use to determine the owner benefits, because there are some items that are added together to figure out how you come to the owner benefit number. And listeners, write this stuff down. So in other words, you know, what is the formula to come to the owner benefit number? Then we can talk about some multiples after.
Owner benefit is the amount of money that's available to an owner to either pay debt service or to pay themselves. So what we do is we go right to the tax return or the income statement. We take the bottom line first, net income. We add that to depreciation or interest that has been deducted. We also use amortization or taxes. So basically, that's what we call EBITDA. And on top of that, you add the owner's salary, the owner's share of payroll taxes, and any perks that the owner may get in the form of non-business expenses like cars or life insurances or health insurances or paying other family members. And we add that all together, and that's owner benefit.
Wonderful. I mean, that's actually a great number. And one of the things, so just to repeat for people, you've got the, let's call it the pre-tax income off the tax return, plus the owner salary, plus the owner perks, plus depreciation and interest and amortization. And there's one other point that has to be modified to that, which I want to talk to you about in a second, because it's you want to expand upon these issues. And it's common for small business owners to put through some personal expenses in the business. So with add-backs, one thing we'll agree, they've got to be related to the business. So if an owner is putting through his son's car and his son doesn't work in the business, well, that's clearly a legitimate add-back and it's income that the new owner would have. Similarly, if a owner is trying to add back his own car or his cell phone, which you see over and over again, but the truth is he needs his car or some form of vehicle and his cell phone to operate the business, that's not a legitimate add back.
I saw a good example of that is I had a seller who was selling a florist and they had a Jeep and they wanted to add back the Jeep. And they said, well, we only use our personal Jeep twice a year. And I'm like, what, Mother's Day and Valentine's Day? when you do 25% of your business, and you're like, yeah, of course.
Well, then it's not an ad back.
That's not an ad back.
And the second thing is, you know, making an allocation for future capital expenditures in asset-heavy businesses. And I like to use the formula that we've just discussed, which is net income plus owner's salary plus perks plus depreciation plus interest plus amortization, less an allocation for capital expenditures. If you're buying an asset-heavy business, you can't add back all the depreciation. I'm sure you'll agree. If someone is going to have to spend money in a year, 2 years, 3 years to replace equipment. Now, if the equipment is that they're inheriting is good for a decade, that doesn't necessarily apply, but most time it doesn't. So people at least have to pay attention to asset-heavy businesses, what theoretically they're going to have to allocate for big expenditures in the near term.
I agree with you, but you know, comparing apples to apples to apples, you take the whole owner benefit and you use that to calculate value. But you also have to be cognizant of what your cash flow is going to be. You have to understand your debt service. You're going to have to understand your CapEx, your capital expenditures. So, yes, you're absolutely correct. But just be careful that, you know, people do use the whole owner benefit too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of looking at each individual business and making sure, you know, if it's an asset-heavy business, you can't sort of just broad brush, let's say, adding back depreciation if there's an offsetting amount. It's just, you know, we want people to be aware of some of the things that are going to come into play with different types of businesses.
We see that typically in landscaping businesses and car rental businesses can have huge amounts of depreciation that really shouldn't be calculated toward valuation because there may be a lot of CapEx in the future.
Right, I mean, or not all of it. When you're trying to value any one of these type of businesses, what's something that people need to hone in particularly? For example, in retail, I'm assuming you're going to say inventory.
Inventory was first.
Or lease, right?
Well, so, inventory and lease, and then what's around you. I mean, what kind of customer are you looking for? If you're buying a, say, card store and you're next to a huge supermarket, and that supermarket moves out, then you're cooked, you're done. So you want to make sure that in retail, a lot of times it's location, 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 and you want to understand where your customers come from and what's important in that. So I'd say inventory is very important, and at the same time, where your customers come from.
And how they get there. I mean, there could be situations where someone could, in that same plaza, is not reliant on that anchor tenant because they may be a destination location. They may be a specialty shop. They may be, you know, a shop that caters to, you know, weddings and typically outfits the bride and the mother of the bride,
right,
if you will. And someone's going to come. They're not happen to be going to the grocery store, picking up a bag of bananas and say, you know what, I'm going to buy a wedding dress. That's a destination location. But the card shop is critically dependent upon that anchor tenant.
Correct.
And let's say in a manufacturing business.
Well, manufacturing oftentimes is about margins, about gross margin. And you want to make sure that you're going to be able to make money. I mean, you know, in the end, all these businesses, number one's making money. But, you know, manufacturing, I would be very concerned of who your customers are. And these days, you're always worried about manufacturing going overseas. So you want to make sure that you have a good gross margin and the ability to keep your gross margins here in the United States.
Right, that it's not, you know, it's not going to convert to offshore manufacturing. Now, let's say in a pure service business, because again, pure service business, they may have desks and chairs. I mean, that may be the assets. They may have a couple of computers, some paper clips, and to the outsider who, you know, someone who's looking to buy an asset-heavy business, that's air. But, you know, service businesses represent the majority of businesses across America and mostly outside of Asia, probably the majority of businesses sold in the world. So what are, you know, one or two key things that someone has to look for in a pure service business? I know it's a broad spectrum. But
pure service business is all about the customers.
Simple.
Who are the customers?
Very simple. And are they going to stay on board?
Are they going to stay? And how are you going to get more?
Right. So in other words, and make sure that as the owner walks out the door, so too don't go the customers.
I agree.
Okay. Let's talk about in a wholesale distribution business. And, you know, in another session, you know, when talking to people and identifying attributes that they should or shouldn't have related to certain entities, when I talk about wholesale distribution businesses, I, you know, personally don't like them. And I owned a couple of them, but I don't like them because you're sort of stuck too far in the middle.
Right.
You got your suppliers on one hand, you got your customers on the other, and you're stuck in the middle. You don't really own anything. You don't really control anything. And you're at the whim of both. It's sort of like seesaw or ping pong. But they are very good businesses. So what would be the single most important thing that you would tell someone to look at related to the valuation of a wholesale distribution?
Well, I think you mentioned that you're stuck in the middle. So you want to understand where you are in the supply chain and whether or not you can go away. And what add value do you add to the manufacturers or your suppliers before you said, I mean, if you're supplying, say, dirt and you're taking in huge amounts of dirt from wherever it comes from in trailer loads and you're parceling it out to smaller. I mean, that could never go direct to the manufacturers. Same, I think fuel, you know, the fuel comes in these huge tanks and they have trucks and they parcel it out to the local. So I think you're kind of locked into the supply chain there. But, you know, if you were supplying, say, musical instruments and you're selling these musical instruments as it, I think with the internet today and with manufacturers trying to cut the margins as far as they can go direct, and it gets scary.
So in other words, it was a good example, because a musical instrument, if someone is a manufacturer and they had local distributors before who may have operated at a local retail music store, and those have sort of all but disappeared, and if they were supplying, you know, the bands of the local high schools or individuals looking to take lessons, lease spaces, it would be very easy through the internet for someone to go in and just sign up for, you know, to get a trumpet and pay them on a monthly basis. They don't need that middleman anymore. Good example. Okay, there's a huge difference between valuations of businesses on Wall Street versus Main Street. We hear terms of 5, 10, and 20-time multiples in business sales of large public companies. You alluded to some of those earlier. So how does the actual multiple, or what is being multiplied, differ when it comes to valuations of small businesses versus large ones?
Well, you have to understand what you're multiplying. I mean, the number that is in the public markets is for a highly a business that is being very professionally run, a business that can that the stock can be traded in an instant to somebody else. So it's highly liquid. The businesses, the money that makes it down to the shareholder is after that there's professional management paid and there's debt service paid and they keep money back for CapEx and they only do distributions, you know, every once in a while. Some public companies never do distributions. So the money that's multiplied in the public markets is a lot smaller as compared to owner benefit, which includes earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, and the owner's salary and the, you know, president's salary. So sometimes they might equal one another if you were to take the owner benefit, say, of, and Microsoft is a horrible example. But if you took the, you know, owner benefit, if you took out all the top management and everything else that perhaps is, you know, too much, and you were to calculate it compared to owner benefit, they might actually equal one another.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I've done the exercise a few times. I have one client who's a very financially savvy individual, and we've joked back and forth very often and said, you know, this is 5 times EBITDA, 3 times owner benefits. Pretty close.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
It's pretty close. So now let me get your knee-jerk reaction to the following question. What is the average multiple that businesses are sold for historically?
2.
Next. I'm completely, I sort of say that in jest because the truth is, I mean, it's everyone can have their argument back and forth, but the truth is, if you take historical sales of small businesses and you take the proper formula for owner benefit, they are going to sell at what times multiple? Again, at average across the board.
2. If you took some of the databases out there, and we used to be able to take the whole database and put them into a spreadsheet where they got smart, they don't let us do that anymore. But if you took them all, you get it like 1.9 or 2.1. It's incredible how it all revolves around 2. Now, that's an average.
Right.
Some of them went for 3. Some of them went for 1.
Right.
Some of them went for a half.
Right.
Some of them went for 4.
Right.
And now we're going to talk about what's the difference between a 1 and a 3.
I mean, because there is some substantial difference. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of those huge databases to establish some of those averages, you know, get us into an area which, you know, I'm really opposed to using any rule of thumb basis to establish the core valuation of a business, because I don't believe you can compare any two businesses that are living, breathing entities like you can in real estate, for example. You know, and unlike you, there are many experienced business brokers that will often use rules of thumb as the, you know, as the selling tool in their valuation. And it is a resource, but it is not a method alone to establish a valuation. So tell us how can a buyer combat that argument?
Because rules of thumbs are come from real valuation methods for businesses. And let's say a business had a customer that 50% of the sales was one customer, and it was very questionable whether or not that customer was going to stick around. Well, would you use a rule of thumb that perhaps valued businesses that aren't in that kind of situation? So, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, rules of thumbs are good for gut checking. But as far as living and breathing and dying by them, that's not good, because businesses are a living and breathing thing. And a lot of them have different symptoms, different strengths and weaknesses. And you have to pay attention to those.
Right.
And really, business is going to be valued on an individual basis. It's an art.
You know, you've often said, you know, business valuations is an art. It's not a science. And it's a great way of reducing. It's almost reducing it to the absurd so that the average person could understand because, you know, yeah, their data and yes, their numbers, numbers don't lie, but there's no scientific formula that's established that will, you know, categorically covers the valuation of every type of business. It just doesn't work. And no two businesses are the same. So will the value of a business change due to location, geography, economy, and competition?
Absolutely. 100%.
Okay. And that's a perfect example of what you talked about earlier, rules of thumb, because you could have one business where they do 60% of their business with one client versus a similar, quote unquote, similar business that does 60% of their business with 150 clients. Or one business, you know, two businesses are making 100 grand a year. Well, they're not worth the same because one made 200 grand the last year and the other one made 50. So one's trending up, one's trending down. They're not worth the same. You know, a large part of business valuation must be done using past provable financial data. However, every business buyer wants to know about the future. So how can someone estimate the future value of the company? And don't just mean financially from a discounted cash flow. More philosophically, they see this business, the past financials seem to check out, you know, and everything is, you know, what the sellers represented or it has been able to be validated. How could someone really look at the business and say, you know, what does the future really hold for this business? What are a few points, you know, points one, two, and three that they could do a proper check to say, hey, it looks like it's pretty good. Without, of course, we can't predict the future.
Right. I think they have to look and see if they're going to be able to continue that business as the past owner did. And so you want to look at your lease costs. I think that's important. You know, a lot of times when businesses sell, they've been under this long-term lease and they're on this hot street, and then all of a sudden they go to get an assignment, and the lease spikes up. The other thing is that you want to make sure that the customer's going to stick around. We've talked about this early. Got to make sure those customers going to stick around. And the last is where do you get your sales from? Advertising, marketing, salespeople. What's the engine that drives that business? And if you're going to be a good engineer, if that engine's going to thrive under your presidency, you should do fine. And that's what you really want to teach. I say this all the time. You want them to just focus on the past, but understand the future. What is it going to take for the past to happen again? And if it's been happening over and over and again, and it has a 5% growth curve, and you think that you're not going to do anything drastic as far as changing it, we've talked about that, you should be okay.
You know, it's interesting because I always tell people when you're doing evaluation, you have to pay for the past, you consider the present, but you're buying it for the future. So now we understand the various valuation methods, and I think you've done a great job simplifying them for everybody. We know what method works best, and we're clear about what multiples to apply. We also know a number of things to look for with specific businesses. So let's discuss precise valuation action steps our listeners need to take. And listeners, write this stuff down. What information and documentation does someone need to have access to in order to properly value a business?
They need the past financials. They need an accurate financials. So they need the tax returns are a great place to start. Say the past 3 years of tax returns. And then you need the current financials. If you're in the first quarter, and you just passed the first quarter, you need the first quarter. You need the second quarter. So once again, a business, you have to consider the past, but you're paying for the future.
You're buying it for the future.
For the future.
Because, and when it's interesting because you bring up a very good point, which is related to tax returns. And some people need to understand that, you know, when they see a business listed at a business for sale website and it may be of interest to them, they can't expect to realistically contact the seller or the broker. And they're not going to be forwarding tax returns to them. That's going to be a process by which they, impress upon the selling party that they're solid, serious and qualified buyers. And that's the information. But, you know, the point being here for our listeners, what Andy is saying is you're going to take these tax returns, you're going to look at those in tandem with the internal financial statements of a company and recent internal financial statements. You're going to be able to validate that at various stages. But those are clear instruments along with a balance sheet that you're going to be able to use to construct the valuation, correct?
Correct. And you can use the broker's recasted financials. And a lot of times if they're detailed, they'll give you the actual tax return or whatever the statement was. They'll show you what their add-backs are and have notes to what those add-backs were. And then they have their financial, their adjusted financial. So those are great to have, too, because then you can understand what they were doing. And so I would ask for those.
And those, again, those are the add-backs or the reconstruction of the adjusted financial statements. So let's assume someone finds a business they like. Walk us through the key steps that a buyer will go through to arrive at a valuation.
Well, they would look at what the representations of the seller was. And they could just go to the representations and try to draw a line of where that business is going to go in the future. And once again, what's happening presently is the most important thing. But you have to consider the past, because if there's something wacky where the business is, has grown ridiculous amounts in the last year, it could be because of the way they handled past financials, the way they handled inventory, how they handled their cash basis, like they're hiding checks all of December and then throwing them into January. So you have to be careful about those things. You want to get to know the business. You want to see where the business is going. So once you have an accurate what you think the current owner benefit is, you can simply multiply by two. I mean, as silly as that sounds, but it
gives you a barometer.
It absolutely gives you a barometer.
And it gives you a starting point. I think it leads very well into the next question that I would like to discuss with you is, let's say a seller has priced their business, you know, just picked an arbitrary number, $500,000. The buyer arrives at a valuation that is significantly less, $300,000. You know, how can they bridge the gap, and what precise tactics can a buyer use to prove to a seller that their valuation is more correct, or, you know, it's closer to being more correct, or it's more closely resembles reality in the marketplace?
Yeah, you know, it gets difficult sometimes because it depends how long the business is on the market and if they've gotten other offers. I mean, if a seller's gotten three offers at $300,000 for that, you know, when they're asking $500,000, maybe they start getting a hint. But if they've been on the business on the market for a week and they get their first $300,000 offer, it may be harder to put, you know, once again, bring third-party references. And the way to bridge the gap sometimes is to be creative. And sometimes you can keep the owner on a earnout. You can use earnouts. You can use balloon notes that are somehow contingent upon future sales. So there are ways to play with it. And I've bought some business brokers myself, and I've used earnouts very effectively and said, listen, if the place makes $1 million, I'd be happy to give you your $500,000. But if it makes $100,000, there's no way I could give you $500,000.
So it's, again, it's example. It's being creative. Mm-hmm. It's plays to what you said earlier, which is, you know, make an offer because it starts it. I mean, and, you know, I fundamentally believe that, you know, it's okay if the seller's insulted. Don't worry if the seller's insulted. It's okay. Go ahead and insult them. I mean, without being reckless, but get the offer onto the table because that's what starts the discussion. And somehow, you know, if you have a buyer who wants to buy and you have a seller who wants to sell and they trust each other, they're going to find, you can't stop them from getting a deal done. Even if they're way apart on valuations, they're going to come up with, as you're saying, creative ways to bridge that gap and to get a deal done. And there are lots of creative ways. I mean, it's interesting, and our listeners will be pleased to know that in one of our upcoming monthly CDs, we'll be doing a comprehensive session on killer negotiating tactics, and we're going to be tackling this very example. So one of the biggest no-nos, and I know you mentioned it earlier, which I had to chuckle when you in one of your replies, which is one of the biggest no-nos is when a buyer makes a significant changes too quickly after they buy a business. So let's say, you know, we know that leads to disaster, but let's say we've got a prudent buyer here. They bought a business. They spend, you know, 3 to 6 months getting to know it. They're ready to make their mark on it. Now, give us a list of the top things that they can do that would make the greatest impact on raising the value of their new business in the shortest time possible with the least amount of effort. Not too daunting a question or a strategy we're asking to put together, but again, they've learned the business. They got the guts of the business in their belly. They're in it for 6 months, 3, 6, 12 months, or whatever the case may be. How can they build value pretty quickly? And when we say build value, obviously, it's to the next person who may be coming along and saying, hey, this business is worth more than that proverbial two times or whatever.
Yeah, well, keep good books and records. Number one, you got to get your books and records right. And since you're starting from the beginning, then I highly suggest that you hire a CPA, you have some sort of computer system, if not a point of sale system, and you make sure that you document inventory. And if you have inventory, but you want to understand, someone wants to know what that business is. You want to have a scorecard. You know, that's what a profit and loss statement is. It's a CEO scorecard. So you want to, as a business owner, you want to know that you're doing well. So that's number one. And then all the other things that go into the, you know, just cleaning it up and making it look good, but not changing the feel of it. I wouldn't go crazy changing many things. But making all the employees feel good and just kind of putting new advertising in place, growing sales. All those things are important to the next buyer. So, but streamlining and, you know, we talked about you want to systematize businesses.
It's interesting because the suggestions that you make, we're not talking about sending men to the moon. These are very rock solid, simple changes and policies, procedures, and systems that people can put into place that are not beyond anybody that will immediately improve the value of a business. In addition to the fact that they're going to make the business better running businesses today, they'll improve the business, the value of the business down the road. Well, you know, we know that many sellers try to hide some things in a business. But let's touch upon some red flag issues that our listeners should be aware of. Historical valuations won't necessarily highlight issues with the business that may have a huge impact in the near term. So how can a buyer be certain that a seller, you know, is not trying to hide these potential time bombs from them?
Well, they need to hire a good CPA. I mean, they need help. They can't do this on their own, but they can start snooping around. I mean, if they look on a tax return or a P&L or whatever it is, and there's $90,000 of payroll for the employees and there's 10 employees in there, it's approximately $9,000 per person per year.
There's
something wrong. So, you know, we've talked about this before. Maybe they sit there with a cup of coffee and watch the crews go out if it happens to be something. You know, you count the customers as they come in. I mean, you look for abnormalities to, you know, something's not right here. I mean, they're claiming all this income and, you know, you want to look at gross margins over the years if it's significantly changed. You know, they're doing 30% gross margin for 3 years and then this year it's 70%. Well, there's something wrong with the inventory system, something wrong with the accounting system. See, play dumb. I mean, just look for abnormalities and you know, different kinds of trends.
It's interesting because I try to use the example of when I started to learn how to fly fish and said I could never catch a fish when I first started. You're in a river, you're throwing a fly 60 feet down, it's going in the stream. You know, salmon, which I like to fish for, they just come up to the surface, you know, and either try to crack on top of the fly or squash the fly with their mouth. They don't feed in fresh water. So you actually have to hook the fish at the time when its lips are just, or just rolls on top of the fly. Right? I mean, it's very, very hard. And I spend quite a bit of time going on these fishing trips, having a blast, spending all kinds of money, but having a wonderful time with my friends. I just couldn't hook any fish. And I'm, you know, a relatively okay fly fisherman. And I, speaking to one of my buddies, said, you know, I may be crazy, maybe my eyes are bad, but I keep looking downstream 60 feet, and I can't see the little fly. The fly is, you know, barely see it if it's in the palm of your hand. How do you possibly see the fish come up and take the fly? I said, maybe it's my eyes. You know, he said, no. He said, you can't possibly look at the fly. It's impossible to see the fly. Never mind, 60 feet. You can't see a fly 6 feet in front of your nose in the water. It's impossible. It's mixed with the water. He said, you have to look in the area. You know where your fly is because you're following it. If you know, you've thrown your line out and it's drifting in the water, you have a general idea where your fly is, a pretty good idea where your fly is because your rod is pointing at it. He said, all you need to do is look for a disturbance in the water. It just looks unnatural. And I always use that as sort of the analogy to say when you're looking at a business, just look for a disturbance in the water. Look for something that doesn't look natural. And sort of, I said, what do you mean? He said, you know what, if you're looking at the water, you see patterns of the water, the way the water is rolling. You're in a river. He said, something's going to flash. Something looks going to look out of the ordinary. And you'll see it. The next day I went on, I caught 4 fish. And, you know, it was probably the best day I've ever had fishing, but it made perfect sense because you could immediately identify stuff that doesn't look right. And you look at stuff, you know, patterns of or history of data, something sticks out. And so, you know, I tell people, look for a disturbance in the water or the financial waters of a business.
Excellent advice.
How can someone, here's the big million-dollar question, how can someone avoid being ripped off and overpaying for a business?
You know, it's hard. It's a gut feel. You got to look for the disturbance in the seller. You know, for the business, I think you look for the disturbance in the seller. You know, listen, if something's been around for 25 years, it's probably not going to go out of business. If somebody's selling you something that's been in business for 6 months and they just don't seem right and the books don't seem right, you got to run. You got to look. Just got to look at everything.
So you're doing, you know, it's great that you've got all this data, you make all these decisions, but the truth is, you know, when all is said and done, you know, you have to trust your gut, of course.
Yes.
And chances are, you know, we have a whole CD devoted to due diligence. You know, chances are if something is not right with the business, you know, buying a business should never be a leap of faith. You should have been able to do your homework to feel comfortable that you're doing it. I mean, there's always got to be an element of risk. There's always a certain level of anxiety. There's always going to be a certain element of, you know, of excitement. But if something in your gut tells you something's drastically wrong with this business, you've got to believe your gut.
I agree.
Fair enough?
Agreed.
I'm very excited to get to the best stuff of the night, but first I want to tell everyone who's listening what's coming up in our next CD. Next month, we'll be talking to one of the country's top experts in the field of due diligence, and you're going to love this guy. He'll be explaining all the steps you need to take to flawlessly investigate a business, uncover the secrets, and learn everything about it before you buy. Believe it or not, 50% of the deals that are agreed to fall apart in due diligence. You're going to learn how to turn a 50% failure rate into a 90% success rate. Here's just a few of the topics that we'll cover. How to easily tell if a seller is cooking the books. You'll learn how to negotiate a pressure-free due diligence no matter how hard any seller tries to bully you into a short review. There's no doubt that every business has secrets. You're going to discover how to find the most common problems sellers don't want you to know about. You'll also get insight into the major issues that most people never uncover during the due diligence until it's too late. Our expert will share with you exactly what needs to be reviewed. And most importantly, after listening to next month's CD, you'll know how to tell beforehand if any business you consider purchasing will fall apart after the owner leaves. And of course, there's going to be much, much more. Okay, Andy, are you ready for the expert hot seat?
Yes, I am.
We have only about 5 minutes. Our listeners expect to be blown away with incredible information from the best experts we interview on these CDs. And that's not to say what you haven't provided up to this point has been anything less than absolutely phenomenal. But there's no pressure on you here, right? I mean, there's just 5 minutes to come up with a wealth of information for our listeners. Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here goes. Question number one. What are the simplest and most powerful bits of information about valuing a business that you've ever learned, period?
Well, first I learned how to read a balance sheet and income statement. I think that's so important. Once you know the ins and outs of a balance sheet and income statement, know at least the beginning steps, that is so important. Number two is I now understand how people play with numbers. And I think it's important for you to know how the business plays with numbers, because where there's smoke, there's fire. So you got to understand how they're playing with the numbers. But in the end, it's all about the future. I don't care what happened in the past. I don't care that the business was making tons of money. The only question I want to know is it going to happen again? A business is where the quality and quantity of the earnings drives multiples. So you want big, I want solid profits, and I want to make sure they're going to happen again.
That's great advice. In other words, and especially the last point, so you want to make sure that whatever you're buying, it's not only sustainable, but I could build upon it into a great business. Here's question number two. If our listeners only walked away with what you're about to say right now about valuing a business and they absolutely have to be successful, what would you tell them?
Focus on verifying the income.
Pretty simple.
Simple.
Great answer.
Multiples will just exacerbate a bad number.
Right. Okay. So
you multiply a bad number, you got a really bad number now.
Especially, right. You multiply it by anything greater than 2, 3, or 4. Right.
Right.
Good point. Question number three. What are two of the biggest mistakes people make when they are trying to value a business, and what should they do about it?
Well, number one, they apply the wrong valuation method to the wrong numbers. So, you know, they apply an EBITDA multiple that's out there for mergers and acquisitions to a small little business. And I call it, you know, operating on a gnat with human surgery tools.
I mean, very good.
It's ridiculous.
Very, very good.
And the other one is focusing on the past. Everybody's focusing on the past, focusing on the past. It's all about the future.
Very, very interesting. Question number four. What is the single biggest thing that you've learned that has helped you as a person to become successful in life?
How to work with others. How to play in the sandbox of life. That's it.
Thanks again, Andy. By the way, if any of you, although Andy and Transworld Business Brokerage is based in South Florida, they have a wonderful website with great links to other websites as well for businesses for sale, a wealth of information and great resources. You should take the time to visit it at www.tworld.com. That's www.tworld.com, transworld.com, www.tworld.com. Andy, thank you so much again for getting together with me today. You've shared some amazing, amazing information with everyone. And I hope you'll join me again in the future. I really look forward to our next discussion.
Absolutely. Anytime, Richard.
Thanks again.